weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to the two Johnnies for kicking off the week with plenty of entertainment. It is Monday, October 2nd. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan will reflect on all of the drama in the League of Ireland and English Premier League over the weekend. Remy Burns puts into perspective just how big of an achievement Europe's Ryder Cup win was. We'll also hear from Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy. And in rugby, we'll hear from Conor Murray as we begin our build-up to Ireland-Scotland this Saturday. As always, if you want to have your say, text us 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there, good evening. Great to have your company on 2FM. Hope you had a great weekend and you're having a good Monday. The man standing across the room from me, Alan Colley, certainly had a good weekend. You had a couple of live football matches you took in. You were at Tala on Friday, which we'll gloss over. And then you were at London, or in London I should say, at Tottenham Liverpool, which we will be delving into in detail in our football chat, but obvious dramatic narratives, but as an event, as a trip, it was an enjoyable time for you, Alan.
Yeah, fantastic weekend, Shane. Lucky boy to obviously be working on the game Friday and then, as you say, to fly out Saturday morning over to, I suppose, the hottest ticket in town, Spurs and Liverpool, because of the starts that both of them have had in the league, obviously. And yeah, brilliant day. We were hoping that it would be a great game. It was set up to be a great game.
It was a great game for what? First half
hour? Yeah, about half an hour. Yeah. But funny enough, Shane, like, I know, as you said, we'll delve into the football aspect later on in the chat and more of an event, and it's just incredible. If you get a chance ever to go to the stadium, it's absolutely fantastic. And we've been over there obviously the last couple of seasons when things haven't been as good and almost borderline toxic in terms of the negative football and I suppose the disputes with the managers and the owners and all that kind of stuff that has happened over the last couple of years. But to go into it this time, sun was shining, lovely evening in London, a balmy evening, and obviously the team playing unbelievable brand of football, young, exciting, fresh, energetic team with a brilliant manager on the sideline. The place was absolutely bouncing, I have to say. It was really, really good. And then as the controversies were developing, I suppose from a fans' angle and from a spectator's point of view in the stadium, and this is my point, and we'll get to it later on, I suppose, when we do go into those chats, but you don't get any feeling of that there's controversy happening at all, which is such, you basically, it just comes up on the screen, VAR check, like for say for example Diaz goal, that was down the other end to where we were, and it was an unbelievable finish, and we just presumed obviously he's gone in, scored the goal, and then you see the flag and you think, oh, it's offside. It comes up on the screen, VAR check, and then once the check is over, you just presume, oh, they've got that right, and the game moves on. It was only till we came out of the ground that realised there was all this controversy going on and mayhem basically amongst all the decisions. The Curtis Jones one, to be fair, and I often go by the players' reactions. The players were furious, the Spurs players, but even Curtis Jones was so apologetic as soon as he did it, almost to the point of being guilty. So that was the one where I thought, and then when I saw it back, I see both sides of the argument, obviously. People saying he tried to kind of put his foot over the ball to maybe drag it back, and but once his foot goes over the ball like that and you clatter into Bissouma in the manner that he did, I think you're always going to get a red card nowadays. The other ones, then we just presumed there were the two yellows for Jota, that the first one he clipped his heels, that's what it looked like in the ground in the stadium, and yet when you look back on the replay, obviously Adogi's to his feet, he just kind of clips his own heels, but the second one was stupid on his part. So it's amazing, really, like it was an unbelievable evening. Then to get the winner in injury time, obviously it doesn't get much better than that. My little lad who loves Spurs was going bananas, and the stadium absolutely erupted. Like, you don't get a better finish than that, regardless of, I suppose, the controversies in the game. From a Spurs point of view, it was just incredible, but just from a spectator's viewpoint, and I've read all the debates and discussions around VAR today and yesterday, the audio has to come in where the fans know and can hear exactly what's happening in terms of a conversation between the officials, because we were completely in the dark. Everybody in that stadium was completely in the dark until they walked out of the ground and maybe spoke to their friends or went on their phone and realised what was going on. Which can't be right.
No, it certainly can't. And I will be posing the question to yourself and Fergal about how do we change VAR for the better, or perhaps is the answer just to disband it completely. But 51552 is the text number. Alan, you're a man of the people. Adrian from Leash texts in saying, "Hi Shane, had the pleasure of meeting and chatting to Alan and his son while boarding the flight home on Saturday night." So yeah
plenty of fans. I was
over actually in Old Trafford myself. Didn't have the weather you had.
Yeah.
Manchester was on lockdown.
Hard result.
Conservative. Yeah, didn't have the result. Now, admittedly, I was there as a neutral spectator. I love Manchester City, but Manchester, the city, I should say, not Manchester City. Manchester, the city. Yeah, the city was on lockdown. There was a Conservative Party conference or something, so it was just, you couldn't move about as freely. The weather was awful and the match was...
So your experience was the complete awful. Opposite
it was
of
the opposite of you. But there were, as like Adrian and Leash and many others, there were plenty of day trippers over.
Yeah, and that was amazing. Like, obviously, we met Adrian, lovely lad. Yeah. So many people who go over, obviously, for the day, like, and obviously, hardcore fans just flying out over for the day. Absolutely brilliant. You meet so many people, and look, the Irish are generally sound no matter where you go, and they all up chatting to you and all. It's brilliant. Like,
yeah, know? It was. I think in the airport, I spotted Wolves, Crystal Palace, United, and a Spurs jersey. So, yeah, there's plenty.
I'm over again this week. So
how are
great.
You? Yeah. You're off Luton Town. Spurs?
Luton Town.
You get to see Kenilworth Road.
Yeah. That Imagine. Will be an experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it was a weekend that Ange Postecoglou and Shane Lowry reaffirmed themselves as being two of the nicest people in sport, really. There was a small matter of golf on. We will be chatting to Remy Burns very shortly. But Alan, I know you're a golf fan as well. I'm sure you were over the moon with the manner of Europe's victory.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. I was actually up early on Saturday morning from 6:30 to watch the start of it before we went.
You had a long day.
It was a long day, but I was up glued to it. And then obviously all day yesterday, the singles was absolutely fantastic, and as you say, to see Shane right in the middle of it, in the heart of it.
You would say he clinched it, like, you know, it was last minute put or something. Like, Shane, it's done, mate.
And he's still giving us socks. And then a few videos circulating, obviously, last night, the celebrations carrying on. But even a couple of players that stood out for me, and obviously we have our Irish hat on, but someone who I've admired for a long, long time in that team, and just because the way he conducts himself and goes about his business throughout his career, and he kind of had his moment in the sun as well, and this could be his last one, Justin Rose. I thought he was absolutely brilliant, and seems like a really good fella, as does Luke Donald as well. I've always admired Luke Donald as a player. Again, something similar to Rose, the way he conducts himself, and even as the captain and all. And just listening to Paul McGinley, who did a brilliant job himself when he was the captain, he was claiming that Donald has literally taken it to a different level in terms of the setup and what he created for them, and to get them to all buy into that kind of team ethic that they have, and the spirit and the bond and all that kind of stuff. And that was evident, because you look at America and just
how disjointed
and divisive they seem, and just kind of almost individuals, and how like. And I felt sorry for Zach Johnson, because he doesn't strike me as that type.
Yeah,
he comes across actually something similar to maybe Donald and all, and he was very magnanimous in defeat and very classy in everything that he said, but almost to the point where they're letting him down, a lot of them, like, you know. And it was only really till yesterday that got a bit of a fight on, I suppose, and maybe that kind of sparked them, the little incident with Rory on Saturday evening, I don't know. But it was brilliant to see Europe win, obviously, and fully deserved as well. I thought they were fantastic. The whole lot of them were brilliant, and it looked like a great event.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Irish interest in the golf, we can hear from Shane Lowry. He was speaking to RTE's Greg Allen.
This is a big day in my golfing career. Something that I've wanted to achieve for a long, long time. And like, my dreams are coming true today, to be honest. I'm looking forward to sitting back over the next few weeks and taking it all in. And I've got 6 weeks off now, which is really nice. And then, I'm going to have to do my best to set some goals for next season, but right now I don't really care about that. I'm just, you know, trying to enjoy the moment. And what a day out there. I was hoping it wasn't going to come down to our games at the back. Me and Tommy and Bob, we talked about it in the locker room this morning before we went out, but it did. And you know, we all showed a lot of heart and a lot of fight, and thankfully we came out on the right side of it.
You played great today, and Jordan Spieth played great. Yeah. Nobody kind of expected that he would, because he had a poor enough first couple of days, and suddenly you're firing birdies at each other. But satisfaction-wise, when it did come down to you, you really manned up. You made the putts, the birdies.
So that's what's the most pleasing part. You know, I knew going into the back nine that the Ryder Cup was potentially in my hands, and I felt incredibly calm. I trusted my game a lot. I hit some very good shots, and I made putts when it mattered, and that's what was amazing out there. And I showed myself, and I showed everyone else, you know, how good I can be on this stage.
you threw so many eggs into this basket, as you said in the Ryder Cup. Yeah. You know, the feeling by comparison to winning the Open. They say comparisons are odious, yeah. But tell me.
Come on! Right now it feels better. Do you know what I mean? It's, I would say it's on par. Like, I've achieved, obviously, some great things in golf. Winning the Open in, you know, my home country, being one of them, but this is like something. I'm going to put that replica Ryder Cup trophy that we get right in beside the claret jug in my trophy case, and that's going to be a very proud moment for me, and it's amazing. Yeah,
you said, by the way, at the start of the week that if you won no points you'd still be happy for the team. You're a team person, you get the whole team thing, and you really wanted this for the team. Having said that, you had a half point today which could have been the half point that won the match. To have that satisfaction of making that contribution to the team as you did, what was that for you like?
There's not many thoughts that didn't go through my head on that back nine today. You know, I thought about all the Irish players in the past that have held winning putts in the Ryder Cup, and I felt like this could be my time. And to be honest, I felt if I had a decent shot into 17, that could have been it. I could stand there talking to you all night. It's just amazing to be standing here with this, being a part of this. Luke, I said to Luke on the back of the 18 green, I thanked him for trusting me. Pick me, trusting me to kind of be one of his picks, because that's not an easy thing to do, to pick a guy to, you know, to help lead the team to victory, and he did that, and I feel like I produced the goods this week.
Well, he certainly did produce the goods this week. The Ryder Cup on par with an Open triumph. It's big words from Shane Lowry, but certainly a happy man. Another happy Irishman was Rory McIlroy, and he was also speaking to Greg.
Passion in your person at Ryder Cups is different. We saw it spill over into a situation yesterday when on the 18th green, you know, Joe LaCava, the caddy of Patrick Cantlay, moved into your space, so to speak. And that resulted in an incident in the car park afterwards where you got very agitated. Is that part of the week? And did it fuel what you did today? Because you led from the front.
Look, it was an unfortunate incident, and I was disappointed on the 18th green because, like, I felt like I played the match yesterday in the right spirit, and I don't feel like that spirit was reciprocated to me on the 18th green. But like, we move on, and it doesn't like.
That kid back in 2010 in Celtic Manor, you know, with the floppy hair. Now you're the 7-time Ryder Cup veteran of the team, leading in a manner 4 points out of 5. How proud of you of this, and what does this feel like by comparison to the other Ryder Cups that you've been involved in?
Yeah, I'm really proud of myself because coming off of Whistling Straits, I don't know if I'd ever felt so low, not even just in a Ryder Cup, but in my career in general. You can trace my form back over the last couple of years to that Sunday at the Ryder Cup of Whistling Straits. It meant the world to me that these guys believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. And to have a group like that around you that does believe in you, it means the world to me.
So some very interesting post-tournament comments. And now one man that was covering the tour was Raimi Burns, former professional golfer and on media duty in Rome. And Raimi, you're taking the call live from Rome Airport. So we do appreciate you making the time for us. Was this the most entertaining Ryder Cup you've covered, Raimi?
This was incredible. Like, you know, I've seen Tiger Woods win Torrey Pines, you know, seen things happen in golf. First Ryder Cup, 89, standing no more than 30 yards from Christy Jr., the 2-iron over the water, Harrington, Darren Clark at the Belfry, you know, Paul McGinley. This was just unbelievable. This was just incredible. It was just like watching a movie, the whole from Victor Hovland chipped in on the first day until Shane or Tommy Fleetwood finished this match off on yesterday afternoon. Like, looking back, 2 years ago, Whistling Straits, no form in any Europeans. Rory McIlroy underperformed. John Rahm last day underperformed. 2 years ago, to organically grow this team into phenomenal 12 golfers, to bring no passengers to Rome. Every golfer, you know, done put points on the board. They all played the first day. It was just incredible golf. Like, Rory McIlroy, 8 birdies yesterday. I did a match on Friday evening. 21 birdies between the golfers. Like, the American golfers didn't win, but the American golfers played a phenomenal golf, and the Europeans just played better golf. Golf won. This is probably one of the biggest sporting weekends, you know, of all sport all around the world. It's only 3 days, different formats. The USA team just didn't perform over the 3 days.
Mm. Why does the Ryder Cup evoke such emotive golf, do you think?
I think the history. People sit back and watch these things as kids, children, And the fact that it's possibly only 2 years, this type of format, people look forward to that, people plan for it. Certainly the countries and players involved plan for it. It's just got such a tension through the years. This is the 44th Ryder Cup. The next one's already being prepared. Ireland will have it in 4 years' time. It's just a phenomenal exhibition, if you want to call it, of golf. And it means a huge amount to people's career, Shane Lowry's career now. Another, you know, Rory McIlroy, 7 Ryder Cups, only 34 years old. I think he's won 18 out of 33 points for Europe at Ryder Cups. Like, people want this. People want to play in it. These kids are so good coming through now. Sweden, Norway, like Victor Hovland is probably the best golfer on the planet right now. Europe have 3 of the top 4 players in the world. Like Whistling Straits, a few years ago, I mean, I know there's sort of a pandemic Ryder Cup, but they were probably the best 12 golfers that have ever been put on a US team.
Mm.
The US came over here. I mean, and then to do this 2 years later and have these kind of players that are like John Rahm yesterday, I covered John Rahm's game against Scottie Scheffler. Like, that was like a heavyweight bout. 2 players played the match phenomenal. Not one bad word on the golf course, no doubt. They drove the ball almost together on the fairway, hit their irons almost together into the green. It was just a phenomenal round of golf between the number one and the number three player in the world. And he set the tone. He got that half point, which ended up being a crucial point, right down to Bob McIntyre at the last round. Like, Bob McIntyre he started this tournament as a boy and just grew into a man in 3 days. Phenomenal for probably his confidence, career. Straka, phenomenal for him. You know, Shane Lowry, there was sort of people sort of saying that maybe he didn't deserve a pick, but this is a big-time player. He's won big tournaments, and he was a massive, massive part of that team. And then led by the Pied Piper, Rory McIlroy, he leads the team. When he stands on the golf course, it's probably like when Frank Sinatra used to just stand up in Atlantic City to perform. He's such a huge name, a huge driving force behind this team. And to bring it back and to after Whistling Straits and win in the fashion they did, I think it was phenomenal.
What do you put the victory down to? Like, was it a case that Europe's convincing victory was the culmination of months of detailed preparation that perhaps the US team just didn't avail of?
Possibly, you know, not one US player came over to, you know, the Italian Open. They never made it their business to travel over, possibly to play a few tournaments before. I think it was almost 5 to 6 weeks, most of these players hadn't performed. Justin Thomas, Max Homa, he performed in California a few weeks ago, but I think they were a little rusty, their games weren't up to as much scratch as Europeans, simply because the Europeans had played the Irish Open, played Wentworth, had played more golf, possibly you could put it down to that. There's also other things that you might, Ricky Fowler was not well during the week. You know, they were traveling with a sick golfer. He got sick. There's a few other reports possibly that another player of the team is sick, are feeling not great earlier on. Jet lag. You know, there's all sorts of excuses that can come out. But the passion that the Europeans have, I mean, Max Homa was probably the most passionate person on that golf course for the American team. Cantlay showed passion as well. He just wanted to win, play golf. But from following and doing matches, I didn't see the determination in the American team like I saw in the European team. Like Justin Rose, he is just a phenomenal. He's 45 years old. To play and conduct himself, he went around that golf course walking easy, breathing through the bottom of his stomach. He oozes class. The man is just a phenomenal golfer. He wasn't picked a couple of years ago. And he made it. He made it over the last 2 years to get on that team, playing some phenomenal golf at his age, and to win on the PGA Tour and come back. And he was, in my opinion, the driving force behind a lot of the younger rookies that were on this team. And I just think Europe were better, probably. And you know, I mean, they all slept in the same hotel, same rooms. They all had the same food, but they all were here. The weather was phenomenal, but at the same time, European just produced the goods on the golf course. And I think there was more of a determination from Europe. United States players, in my opinion, play sometimes like they're spoiled. They don't play with the heart of the lion. They don't play like it's their last putt or their last game of golf they ever played. Europe threw everything at this. The players threw everything at it. And I think it just paid dividends at the end.
that's interesting because I do want to tease out the kind of the US angle, because there was no public airing of grievances similar to, say, Glen Eagles 2014, Paris 2018, when I think it was Phil Mickelson and Patrick Reed kind of lobbed the hand grenades in. But like Brooks Koepka came out and said, this was the closest team that I think I've been on. We've got a great group of guys. At this week, the European team just hold a lot more putts, a few more chip-ins. We fought hard and I wouldn't want to do it with any other group of guys. And that was a sentiment shared by Justin Thomas, who said the team had bonded by watching American football college games at 5 a.m. We truly got along, he said. There's usually a couple of misfits of people that just aren't part of the team, but we were all one. Do you believe that, or was there a case of, listen, obviously with Patrick Cantlay and everything else and the rumours of a split locker room and everything, like, was it divisive, or they were together but they were just outplayed?
I mean, you can look at it two ways. I mean, most of these kids grew up together playing golf. It was a relatively young American team. Now, I don't know that the private locker room talk or whatever was reported by one of the reporters in regards to Patrick Cantlay. I don't know that. But on the golf course, I seen a lot of the players that seem to play together. I don't know what happened in the background, but from the point of view, had the passion that the Europeans had? Certainly not. They didn't show that on the golf course. They didn't show that in their games. No, if you want something strong enough and you want something bad enough, you'll go to every extremity to find it. And I don't think the American golfers did their homework. They didn't come over here before to play maybe in a couple of, or one Italian Open, or maybe some of them come over to play Wentworth, keep their games in shape. The Europeans did that. The Europeans had probably more experience of the golf course. The American golfers by Sunday were just getting to know the golf course. And I think that played into Europe's hands, the way the course was set up, the way they had the pin positions yesterday. Everything fell into the Europeans' hands. And that's going to happen. When you go to New York in 2 years' time in Bethpage with a New York crowd, there's going to be a completely different Ryder Cup. It's going to be a different team. But they've that to look forward to. The crowd here got behind Europe from early on. And I think that affected possibly the American golfers are not used to playing in that sort of heated, you know, fan attention. Mm. And I just think they were nervous, and I do think some of them were nervous and they weren't used to seeing what was out there. It was like playing in a football stadium, in the middle of a football stadium. There was that many people out there. The emotion was just, I couldn't imagine playing, but certainly from a fan's perspective, you know, the whole of Europe, every country played its part, and they threw everything behind the team. And, you know, everybody can say what they like. I'm not sure about Netflix following Ricky Fowler around. Some players weren't happy with that. Brooks Koepka allegedly getting paid money from Liv because he got on the Ryder Cup team. I don't know all those points, but possibly, you know, if they've been written and put out there by journalists, possibly there's some truth to that. But from what I saw, I did see a good bonding American team all getting on well together and putting greens, practice rounds, etc. But I didn't see the passion. I didn't see the heart that the Europeans had. I just didn't see that over the 3 days.
How much credit should Luke Donald get as well? Because there's even talk of now perhaps him staying on as captain for 2025, which is going to be a cracker of a Ryder Cup. But in terms of, I suppose, it boils back down to preparation and planning for this tournament led by Luke.
Well, like Luke Donald didn't ask for this. Luke Donald was thrown this when Henrik Stenson had to give up the captaincy. So for what Luke done, what his family did, you know, over the last year, we all know he's a gentleman. He's an English gentleman. He's number one player in the world. And, you know, everything that he wanted, even a speech when he opened up speaking in Italian, you know, he put every country, he put every player at the forefront, and the players got what they wanted, and the players delivered for Luke Donald. Luke Donald's a very experienced golfer. Attention to detail is unreal. And it showed. He even thanked the caddies, he thanked the players, he thanked the families. And that's what counts. And I think Luke Donald had more passion. And I think he spoke to the likes of Rory and he said, look, you got to come over here after the Irish Open. In between Wentworth, Rory, Shane came over. All the players came over. They played the golf course, the team, the bonded, they stayed in the hotel. They knew where they were coming to. Whereas the American golfers didn't really know where they were coming to. And they were just going to go to Rome to play in a Ryder Cup. And then they got here and, wow, hold on a minute. And they just didn't prepare for what was at stake, unfortunately. The Europeans did. Rory Parikh.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, it's a beautiful description you've offered us there. My final question to you, because it was an action-packed weekend, but if you had to pick one standout moment or highlight for yourself, Rémy, what was it?
I think the highlight for me was when I was on the 18 green and I followed the kid for a long time, Shane Larry, and I'm very fond of him, like most of the country is, and to do what he's done, winning the Irish Open as an amateur, then winning the Open, and I was at the Open as well. I did Shane's game coming in down the stretch, and you know, I had tears in my eyes for his father as well, because the family unit. I know what Brendan and his mom had put, his wife had put into Shane over the years, and traveling here and traveling everywhere, and getting people to help, and Neil Manship and the whole crew, the Golfing Union, Golf Ireland now, and you know, to come up from those roots and then achieve, and for young people to be looking at seeing this in front of them. I'm delighted for Shane Larry. I'm delighted the way he conducted himself, you know, totally professional. And I just think he was the standout guy. The standout moment for me was when I was standing, you know, 4 or 5 yards from the 18, and he gave me a little click in the fingers. And I just thought that's just so nice for that guy to achieve what he's done, and then just top it off with this in the Ryder Cup. It's just, you know, Philip Walton's done it. Christy Jr.'s done it, Paul McGinley's done it, but it's so nice for Shane Larry, an absolute gentleman, to achieve what he achieved yesterday, 4 years. He fought back from one of the gruelest golfers you'll ever play against, Jordan Spieth, a very, very popular golfer around the world, and to do what he'd done under pressure, because he knew in the back nine, it may come down at that stage. We were counting the board, it may come to that game, and to get a half point was just unbelievable.
Well, on that note, Rémy Burns, thank you very much for taking the call. Safe trip home and safe flight. A great weekend it was. A sensational weekend for Shane, for Rory, for Europe and for golf in general. Lots more to come on this evening's Game On. We're going to hear from Conor Murray on rugby. But up next, Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan will be chatting football. So stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we turn attention to football. Before we do, 51552 is the text number, as I mentioned. We've a text in saying, please don't forget to mention that was a huge weekend for Irish cycling as Oisín O'Callaghan won the Elite Men's Downhill World Cup in West Virginia, USA, and Ronan Dunne was second, and Irish won two, the first time ever in Irish cycling history. We certainly won't forget to mention that. That was a great achievement. Oisín was actually on with Marie, I think in the past 2 weeks, on Game On as well. So that's podcasted if you want to have a listen back to Oisín chatting to Marie about his fancying his chances. And it has paid dividends for him anyway. I think he's currently in transit to Canada, so no doubt we might get him back on the show in due course. But very big congratulations to Oisín and Ronan. Okay, Fergal Brennan joins me. Alan Colley is still in studio. Fergal Brennan, if I come to you first, because you are on the beat in Liverpool, England, as a journalist, and you might be able to update us with what the latest is on Liverpool versus VAR.
Yeah, another weekend and another VAR controversy and another PGMOL apology. Three controversial issues from the Liverpool-Tottenham game at the weekend. Brilliant game in terms of excitement, but again, dominated by errors and mistakes made by the officials, both on the pitch and VAR. The main point of controversy is surrounding the Luis Diaz first half own goal that was disallowed for offside. I think to the naked eye, anybody watching it on television or possibly even people that were at the ground would say that he appeared onside. There's a trailing leg from, I think it's Christian Romero, playing him on. He runs through, scores. The goal is flagged and then checked by VAR and eventually chalked off. Liverpool go on to lose. In the aftermath, Jurgen Klopp was very calm in his post-match press conference. He's been in this situation before where he's criticised referees or he's criticised decisions against Liverpool. And as he mentioned himself, it's only his bank balance that suffers. They've now come out and said, Liverpool this morning, that they are exploring options. Now, this is something that has caused a lot of debate, particularly on social media, as to what does this mean? Could it be something as bizarre as a replayed game? Will they be looking for the Premier League to take action? I think it's more likely, which they've also asked for, the VAR audio to be released, which was the conversation between the referee, which was Simon Hooper, and the two VAR officials, which are Darren England and Dan Cook. They've both been stood down for the rest of the weekend, and it's probably unlikely that they'll be on duty next weekend. I don't think it goes any further than that in reality. The PGMOL have apologised. They've admitted that it was a clear error made by the two VAR officials. I do think they will release the audio. There's been six examples this season where audio conversations between VAR officials and match referees have been released. And I think that's realistically all Liverpool can hope for. And I think the aim from Liverpool's position is to say, look, here we have the actual conversation that went on, and this proves that the standard of officiating is not up to scratch. And we all know that, but I think they want to be able to hold off a body of evidence, hold up an audio recording that shows exactly why, where and when this decision was effectively made in error. But in terms of anything else other than that, I fully don't think it will stretch anymore. I think we'll have more VAR errors in the weeks and months to come. We'll have more PGMOL apologies. But this was a big one. You can obviously never predict the ebb and flow of a game, but Liverpool have got a really strong case to say this cost them big time in terms of the result on Saturday evening.
Yeah, I think, Alan, if Liverpool end up finishing 1 point off with winning the Premier League,
Fear and that's the danger, Shane, because these decisions are so, so important and you want accountability. And that's why I've never been far VAR. I've always been consistent on this. When it's the goal line technology, I'm fine with that because it's facts. And obviously with the offside, I kind of came round to that idea. I hated the toenail kind of offsides and stuff like that, when that used to frustrate me, when they used to draw the lines. But effectively, I came around to the idea that it's factual and it was almost non-debatable. But when you see a mistake like we saw at the weekend, that makes you question everything, Shane. And the reason I never wanted VAR, because any of the subjective decisions like we see with the red cards or the penalties, you're literally going from one human on the pitch up to another human in the office who has his view, that's telling the ref kind of how he sees it. Yet all of us in the stand have our own view. You're sitting at home watching it, you have a view, everyone has opinion. So again, we're kind of back to the same situation. The goal line technology and the VAR for the offsides where you used to draw the lines, I can live with that. But the one at the weekend, if you're getting those wrong, and that was so badly kind of messed up in terms of how the process of how they got it wrong, because I've listened to the explanation where obviously they felt the on-field decision was that it was given as the goal and the check complete and they carried on and it was just miscommunication. But even at that, Shane, the whole idea of VAR, and I think back to the thing that springs to my mind always is the Henri hand ball, and we always obviously used to say, if we had VAR then, it was easy to look back. I always used to think only include it for something as blatant as that. That's almost like a travesty in the game, something like that happening. And that was the situation on Saturday. That was so bad and so wrong that even though I know the rule said once the game restarted, we couldn't bring it back. Bring it back, because then you wouldn't have this. And the next time the ball went out, just say, look, and hold their hands up and say, I'm really sorry about this. We've had to bring it back. There was a bit of miscommunication. We got it wrong. We hold our hands up. But the correct decision is that goal wasn't offside. It should be a goal, and just play on. And people would live with that, Shane. But here we are a day later, 2 days later, you have Liverpool coming out saying, like, obviously they want the audio and we're going to take this further. I agree with Fergal. How much further can they take it? They can't. But this crack then of just the PGMOL coming back out with apologies like we've seen three or four occasions now, it's not good enough. But particularly for that one on Saturday, it was so badly wrong that they had to bring it back, and there has to be some sort of allowance in whatever process there is, that even though when the game restarts, that we have to be allowed, if it's as blatant and as bad as that, to bring it back.
Fergal, one area that Liverpool might be successful in an appeal is a Curtis Jones red card. And I believe that relates to the VAR official showing the referee a still image, because the rule states the VAR can check the footage in normal speed and or in slow motion, but in general, slow motion replay should only be used for facts. Example, position of offence / player, point of contact for physical offences and handball, ball out of play, including goal or no goal. Normal speed should be used for the intensity of an offence or to decide if it was a handball offence. So judging from the pictures that we've seen on TV, the referee was shown a still image, which shows Jones connecting in a, I was going to say not a violent manner, but in a manner that is a foul. So they might be successful in that regard.
Potentially. So they've launched an appeal this morning. Again, as you mentioned, the still image was the issue here. And it wasn't just that the referee, Simon Hooper, was shown a still image. It was the first thing that he was shown. And I think back to the game on Saturday evening. in the kind of few moments in between him getting the call to say, you need to go to the screen and check this, we can all see watching it that that is the first thing he sees. And he doesn't even request it to be shown in real time. He doesn't request an additional image. He doesn't request any other information to be shown on that screen. The red card is already out of the pocket. Does he go straight? Because he's... Again, we do have this issue with regards to human error. He walks over and he sees that still image and he sees Jones connecting with Bissouma's leg, and that's a red card. If that's the only piece of evidence you have to work off, it's a red card. The issue comes back to, again, this idea of it's not shown within the context of the game. It's not shown at full or match speed. And that will be Liverpool's case. My personal view on this is I do think it actually was a red card. Alan is better placed than me to comment on this in terms of professional football. But I think the way that he goes to tackle, neither player is winning the ball to maintain possession for the next phase of play. They're both going with the same intention to just nick it and a teammate will pick up the second ball. When you go into a tackle like that, I would say from football that I've watched and, you know, the five-a-side games that I've been playing, you don't go for the top of the ball. Mm-hmm. You go to make a block tackle. You go to effectively protect yourself. You aim for the middle of the ball, which is what Bissouma was aiming for, the middle or the bottom of the ball. The expectation would be they both go to win it. It spins off and then either a Spurs player or a Liverpool player wins the second ball. But the whole idea of it being dangerous or out of control or he didn't mean it, I fully agree with that. But it is a tackle that puts itself into that situation whereby you are going to catch him. You're a danger of skidding over the top of the ball when you tackle like that. If you go in to block the ball, if you go in for a block tackle and you go through the ball, and even if he does take out Bissouma or even injure Bissouma, there's no danger to the player. And crucially, there's no still image for Simon Hooper to look at, which sees Curtis Jones connecting with Yves Bissouma's leg. I don't know if that will come into play. That was just my own take on it. I think... potentially, given the pressure, given the noise that is surrounding all this, and we don't want to call into question the integrity of these bodies, I do think the PGMOL will be under pressure to give Liverpool something. So I wouldn't be surprised if this gets overturned as a little bit of a peace offering, shall we say, because they know obviously the other issues, you can't turn back the clock, you can't replay the game. My personal take is I think it was a red card. The way that he's gone in for the ball, you're asking to injure someone. But I do think they might get this given to them because there is so much pressure that Liverpool are putting on the PGMOL and the Premier League.
In the stadium, my initial reaction straight away, I thought he's in trouble because I said, I always look at the players' reactions and the Spurs players were straight in, and Curtis Jones himself, if you look, he knew he had gone over the ball and that he was in trouble. He's almost apologetic in the way he's pleading with the referee straight away. So he knew everything that Fergal has described here, I would agree totally, Shane, I think it was a red card myself as well. I've heard the debate, people saying he was trying to control the ball. You don't try to control the ball like that or do a trick. He knew what he was doing. I'm not saying he's going in to intentionally hurt Bissouma, but once you go over the ball like that, you're asking for trouble, especially in the modern climate that we're in with red cards. So I think it was a red. But what you read out there with the description of what they're going to appeal it on, that goes to show again the incompetence of the VAR referee, because the process that's in place to show the referee, the on-field referee, when he goes over to look at that replay, is to show him a replay, not a still image. So basically, when you look at a still image, Shane, it always looks worse. Every time it always looks worse. And perception is everything. And straight away, when he looks at that, Darren Hooper, when he looks at that straight away...
Simon Hooper.
Yeah. When he looks at that straight away, his perception straight away tells you his foot's over the ball. It looks like he's going to break Bissouma's leg. Red.
Yeah.
Whereas you look at it in real time then, you might have a different view. But straight away he sets him up for a fall. So again, that goes back to the VAR official doing his job wrong.
Absolutely. And there is also an assistant VAR official there. So, you know, it beggars belief how the two of them could have been so out.
But I do think it was a red.
Okay. Well, as do, I'd say, the majority of people as well. Perhaps not Billy in Cork, who texts in, will Liverpool go away and just get over it? Mistakes are made in League One and League Two and in the League of Ireland when all refs are part-time and no VAR in grounds. What will they want to do next? Replay the 66 World Cup? So, yeah, perhaps there are differing opinions.
Well, that's why I don't want VAR. I'm with Billy. Like,
I know.
We go to the games and it's fine.
This is true.
The game was fine before that.
Listen, Alan, as the Guardian noted, it got little lost in the general chaos of puzzled looks
looking bald blokes nominally in charge of a multi-million pound game review system. But Tottenham also won on Saturday.
They did, yeah, they did. And it was really good for the first half an hour, 40 minutes until this stuff started. But in terms of Liverpool as well, we're very, very good, Shane. And it was shaping up to be such a brilliant game because the two teams' approach is all out attack, almost like ding-dong. Basically, you attack, we attack. Mm. And it made for a brilliant spectacle. And I was obviously so excited and in the ground and feeling like this was shaping up to be such a classic game. Spurs... And obviously, we've given them a lot of plaudits on the show so far, rightly so, and the manager, and he's getting a lot of praise again for the job that he's done. But for the first time looking at them, Shane, in a long, long time, there's the makings of a real team here. Players who, like, obviously, we know Madison, who we've waxed lyrical about, Son, all these players who we know they're absolutely fantastic. But the unheralded ones, Pedro Porro was absolutely brilliant on Saturday. And that's one that you kind of think when he came in last year, when he signed, Conte was kind of...
Wasn't given a chance.
Touch and go. Yeah. And there was obviously Emerson Royale was there as well. Matt Doherty was there. And he wasn't allowed attacking the way that he wants to attack Porro because he's all heart. He's up and down. He's brilliant. Modern day fullback, but brilliant. Adoghi on the other side, absolutely fantastic as well. His energy levels, his defending, the way he wants to attack, technically he's very sound as well. The players in midfield, Bissouma is obviously a brilliant player, we know, but Papa Sarr beside him, his energy and his approach to the game as well. So for the first time, as I say, there's a real makings of a team with Spurs. Obviously you look at the strength and depth and there's not maybe that's there yet, but that will come when you think of the job that Postecoglou was done in the space of only 2-3 months. He gets another transfer window. They're only 2 or 3 players away, I think, Shane, like, and that's probably a big statement right now, but they're not far off. They really are not. Obviously it's going to be difficult to maintain the form. I still don't have them as title challengers, but if they were to get into the Champions League, which I do think they have the potential to, and he gets another transfer window and he's there 6 months a year, there's the real makings of a team there. I thought they were very, very good.
Well, only 7 matches played, but they are second in the league, 1 point off Manchester City, so lots to be positive about at Tottenham. Not so much at Old Trafford, Fergal, because I was at the match myself. No creativity, no game plan, too slow, no leadership, a dour atmosphere in the so-called Theatre of Dreams. Just how bad can it get for Manchester United, in your opinion, Fergal?
It's difficult. I don't think that they're sliding and sliding and sliding into the abyss, but it's difficult to see how they can do things differently. I watched the two games, the League Cup game against Palace in midweek and then the league game against them at the weekend, and it was arguably difficult to tell whether United had got their priorities right in terms of the Premier League is still the bread and butter. They're defending the League Cup. They won it last year, but the Premier League is still the big thing. And Crystal Palace, they don't have the squad depth that Manchester United have got. And yes, United have injuries at the moment, but Crystal Palace going to Manchester United on the back of having played there a few days ago, they went back to London, came back up to Manchester. United should be winning that game, even with the players that they're missing. It was a brilliant goal from Joachim Andersen to get the 3 points for Roy Hodgson, and a really, really positive result for Palace. But there's so many games at the moment where United just look lost within it. The Bayern Munich game, the Brighton game going a little bit further back, the Arsenal game, if you want to go back to the start of September, where I wouldn't say the going gets tough. I think just opposition players, opposition managers react to in-game situations, whether they need to change tactically, whether they need to do something a bit different. United don't. They seem to just have a way of doing things. If it isn't working, they just keep hammering and hammering and hammering away. And the Palace back line, it was highlighted on Match of the Day, they were brilliant. Anderson, Mark Waid, Joel Ward, Tyreek Mitchell, they completely nullified United. And that's my concern for them. There is talent there. They've brought in players that, on paper, will do well for them. Hoyland looks a real handful. He will get goals. Not obviously the same level as Haaland, as he's unfortunately being compared to. But Mason Mount is a talented player, but is he going to give them what they need? Is he the player that guarantees them a top four finish or helps them towards a top four finish? Sofyan Amrabat has come in and he's being forced to play out of position. And he obviously came out and said he'd play in goal if Erik ten Hag asked him to, but he's not comfortable. And then you think, well, if he gets to play in midfield, his regular position, is Casemiro going to drop out? Is it going to be the two of them? And then you worry about the lack of mobility that's in there. And Bruno Fernandes, we've spoken about quite a few times, he doesn't like doing the doggies, getting back and tracking back and winning ball. So it's difficult to see how they improve. They'll still get enough points to still be competitive in the push for top four, but guaranteeing top four, potentially winning a cup and certainly making an impact in the Champions League, they need to wake up in games. And Ten Hag has to take responsibility for that, because if you're 1-0 down to Crystal Palace, you need to have a way to get back into it. If Man City are losing, if Arsenal are losing, even Liverpool are losing at home, they find a way to change things and at least give it a go. I don't think United had a real realistic shout of getting back into this. I thought Palace were really good, but United just kind of left it and allowed Palace to just cruise over the line and win.
Absolutely. It was bad news as well for City rivals Manchester City. Alan, how impressed are you with Gary O'Neill so far? Like, might this be a turning point with Wolves defeating City for O'Neill, who seems to be getting a tune out of his players that Lopetegui wasn't?
Yeah, he's absolutely getting a tune out. Well, Lopetegui did well, to be fair, Shane, last season. And I know
near the end of his tenure, perhaps.
Yeah, but when you think of where they were when they came in, and obviously he did a really good job to turn things around there. But in terms of Gary O'Neill, I think he's done a really good job so far when you think how close to the start of the season that he got the job. And this is the thing with Man United, come back to, and I watch Spurs on Saturday, and when I watch Wolverhampton Wanderers, there's an identity and a plan, and you know what they're going to do, and you know what they're trying to do, and you can see a bit of a structure and a shape on the team. I watch Man United, everything seems to be off the cuff. I don't know, are they an attacking possession-based team, a pressing team, a counter-attacking team, a counter-pressing team? It's all off the cuff. And just as Fergal says, whatever kind of way the game is going, we react to it instead of trying to implement what they're trying to do on the opposition and take it from there. So that's a major, and that's on the manager, Ten Hag. But when you look at, obviously, the job that he's done, Gary O'Neill, I think he's done a really good job, to be fair, Shane. And I thought he was harshly treated by Bournemouth. You look at the start that Bournemouth have had as well. Obviously, got beaten heavily at the weekend by Arsenal. And I tell you, there's probably a few Bournemouth fans thinking, I wish we still had Gary O'Neill. I think he's done a really good job. And I've been saying this for weeks. You've all been kind of looking at me as if I have two heads about Man City. But I'm telling you, there's going to be a title race this year. I've said it from day one. You've all been getting carried away. Ruby was on here saying they're going to go unbeaten for the whole season. This will not happen. There's teams queuing up behind him, Shane. And to be fair to Guardiola, who sometimes is a little bit disingenuous, I feel, to the opposition or to opposition managers when they're getting ready to play them. But he's been saying this for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and people were almost kind of laughing at him and not giving him the sympathy. But he has been saying about injuries and we don't have the players and we're struggling and all this kind of stuff. This has been coming, I think, to be fair. There was an unbelievable stat as well I was reading there. I actually screenshotted about Rodri and the amount of games that he's played. And I think in something like 150 games, they've only lost 15. And when he's been missing, and it's something like, or when he's been playing, and then the games that he's been missing has been something like only... I'll have to get the stat and read it, but it's basically that when he's playing, they're almost unbeatable. And the few games that he's missed, they seem to get beaten. And obviously, Calvin Phillips didn't start at the weekend as well. And when he's not getting a start, when Rodri's not there, I think the writing's on the wall for him as well. But I do think we'll have a title challenge this year. And you look at the teams queuing up behind him. So hopefully more teams can take points off Man City, Shane.
Absolutely. I'm still waiting to see when Alex Murphy becomes a breakout star for Newcastle. Never mind your Man City prediction.
He loves to drag things up, don't
he? Okay, well, on stats, Alan, actually, it's the first time that both Manchester and Merseyside clubs lost on the same day since the invention of Velcro. So all four teams are coming.
Yeah, you can read that stat yourself there about Rodri.
Well, Rodri, this is the back of your point. So 5 defeats in 67 when he has played, 5 defeats in 15 when he hasn't played.
Like, that's unbelievable, really.
Since Rodri's debut.
And that's obviously, people know how good he is, but just goes to show the influence he has on that team.
Absolutely. That is where we have to leave our Premier League chat. Obviously, Brighton's midfield came unstuck, 6-1 defeat to Aston Villa in two teams that might be challenging for Champions League football by the end of the year. Newcastle 2-0 winners in 5 games in 15 days as well. So that's going to fixture congestion there. A couple of players missing for the PSG tie during the week, which we'll be previewing in due course. Alan, you're sticking around to chat League of Ireland football. Fergal Brennan, thank you very much as always. We're taking a short break, but stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On
Football.
Now we're continuing with our football chat on Game On because it's time to chat League of Ireland. Alan Colley still in studio. Shane Dawson here with you as well. Big weekend, or big Friday night, I should say, in the League of Ireland. Alan, Rovers winning, Pats winning, Bows winning, Dundalk winning, and Shells losing as a result of Rovers winning in that kind of hunt for Europe and indeed the title. Interesting though, Stephen Bradley after the match, 1-0 victory, probably deserved winners. Perhaps Shells could have nicked a draw, but his comments after about it being difficult to succeed on the pitch when there are some people off the pitch, perhaps curtailing that. He was speaking, I think, to general media as well, but also speaking to Aisling O'Reilly of Off the Ball. But where I saw those comments, is this... like, is there trouble brewing? Perhaps could this be the end of kind of the dominant era for Shamrock Rovers? The team might break up, or will they push on for five in a row? I know the season isn't even completed yet, but we're on the assumption that they will win the league title.
Yeah, for me, Shane, I felt all wasn't right in the camp for a long time now. I look at even the performances in the team, and to me, it's just all gone a little bit stale. But yet they're doing enough to obviously win the league and keeping everybody at arm's length. But those comments tell you there's obviously stuff going on in the background, and we all kind of figure this as well, Shane. And he wouldn't be coming out saying that kind of stuff if it was all rosy in the garden. Now, they're obviously on the verge of winning four in a row, which would be an incredible achievement, and for Stephen as well as a manager, an incredible achievement. But there is definitely rumblings going on in the background in terms of players' contracts, his own contract situation. And it's hard to know until we get the full facts. It's hard to kind of have a view on it, Shane, but there's definitely 100%. I know from even speaking to a couple of people up at the ground on Friday night that, and a couple of people who would have a good in terms of what's going on, and there is definitely some rumblings going on in the background. And who knows, maybe it's Stephen Bradley's time to kind of come towards the end. Maybe he feels that if there is kind of stuff going on in the background that he doesn't agree with. But he's had everything that he's wanted in terms of budgets up there, to have the highest budget by a mile in terms of players and staff. And you look at Shells compared to them the other night, I think it's one third of their budget. Damien Duff's done a phenomenal job, really. So he should be winning the league with the resources that he has. That's not to take away from the achievement, but he should be winning the league. That's the least he should be doing. The European stuff itself, that's where they've obviously let things down, because they've gone out in a whimper again this year in terms of the European stuff. And if there is money kind of, I suppose, a deficit in terms of budgets and stuff, maybe that's where it's stemming from, that they didn't achieve in Europe, and maybe that's what it was budgeted for, I'm not sure. But by him coming out with those comments, there's definitely rumblings in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack Byrne saying he has had no contact over a new deal from Rovers, when Stephen Bradley was saying in April that he had been offered an extension. So something doesn't quite add up there, Shamrock Rovers. There was plenty of good things to be positive about. Unfortunately, that is where we have to leave it, and there is no one more disappointed about cutting a League of Ireland talk short more than I, so I'm certainly not doing it on purpose. Good bit of news, actually. Check out the LOI Twitter feed. Goal of the Month competition.
Unreal.
Belters. Okay. Absolute
name
belters.
The winner.
Oh, no, I'd never.
Robinson Drogheda.
Robinson, that was the first one. There was, and it's the League of Ireland Women's Premier Division as well. So yeah. Rossiter had a great goal against Sligo for Wexford. There are some absolute belters. So yeah, check that out. That is some good news story. Sinead, Laura Lee Davis was our BCO. Ronan Lawler produced this evening's show. Thank you to our contributors. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you
for listening. Beda Silva is up next, so stay tuned to 2FM. Marie Crowe will be back on Game On tomorrow evening from all of the Game On team. It is bye for now.
RTE 2FM.